Sandra Wright, 33457, on behalf of appellants. May it please the court. This case predominantly turns on the procedural due process that is afforded to concealed carry permittees in the revocation of those permits. The sheriff adamantly contends that the Wrights, Edwin and Austin, are not entitled to due process in the revocation of their concealed carry permits. I think that that's been fully briefed sufficiently in the briefs to the court. I'll just briefly hit on the fundamental due process that is inherent in the concealed weapon permitting statute. A division of this court in Copley makes it abundantly clear that when a sheriff seeks to revoke the concealed carry permits, the sheriff must afford procedural due process. Now, the sheriff has urged that the Copley court got it wrong, that they simply assumed that there was a property right that was protected by the Constitution, and that they really didn't delve into it or analyze it at all.
What is the fundamental right under the concealed carry statute?
Well, I would refer to Copley that states that, number one, the permitting statute provides for procedures that the sheriff must follow. And number two,
what is the right? We're not talking about a Second Amendment right here.
Correct. We're talking about fundamental due process. Due process would require notice, an opportunity to inspect and review the evidence, to see what the evidence is being used.
Yes, but the point that I'm asking about is the fundamental right that you claim has been deprived. Because if you don't have a fundamental property right,
okay,
or a fundamental right, you're not entitled to due process.
All right.
And I'm trying to wrestle with the notion that a concealed carry statute somehow confers upon you a fundamental right.
The concealed carry, there's a difference between substantive due process and procedural due process. And even the U.S. Supreme Court has found that there doesn't necessarily have to be a property interest protected by the Constitution in order for there to be procedural due process. We're not talking about substantive due process. We're talking about the procedural due process. And I think that the cases I provided in the brief go there. But with regards to whether or not the court is going to entertain, because I think that the sheriff is trying to get the court to decide whether or not in Colorado a citizen, Colorado citizen, has a right under the Colorado Constitution or the Second Amendment to a concealed carry permit. Now, if you look at, and it's just been recently that that the U.S. Supreme Court has found that there is an individual right granted by the Second Amendment, and that was in Heller case followed up by McDonald, that extended it not just to a militia but to an individual. And you can have the right coming from the U.S. Constitution as well as the Colorado Constitution.
And I don't mean to belabor this point unnecessarily, but I see a distinction, and it hasn't been that long ago in Colorado history, that people wore their sidearms exposed on their hip, and only the people that you really had to watch out for were the people who concealed their weapons. And as I understand the law in Jefferson County, you have open carry in Jefferson County, don't you?
I would not be able to confirm whether or not you can today or not have an open carry, but I don't think that takes away from the fact that the Colorado Constitution really does give its citizens the right to a concealed carry with limitations, and the limitations are found in the permitting statute. The whole list of criteria that you have to take classes, you have to be able to provide proficiency with weapons, and all of those things. So I think that stating that because there's open carry, then therefore the citizen doesn't have a right to a concealed carry, I think we've moved away from that. And I think in 2003, when the General Assembly enacted the firearm statutes that it did, it specifically stated that this is based on a Colorado citizen's right to self-defense. And so I think that if you look at the differences in the language between the Second Amendment, which basically says the right of the people to carry and bear arms shall not be infringed, and you compare that to, which has now been interpreted as providing an individual property right, and you compare that to Colorado, which states that the right of each individual to keep and bear arms is in defense of home, person, and property. And if
Counsel?
Yes.
But you have to finish the sentence.
I'm sorry?
You have to finish the sentence. But nothing herein contained shall be construed to justify the practice of carrying concealed weapons, end quote.
Correct. But then you move forward. That's the Colorado Constitution that has always been in place.
Right. So there's clearly not a constitutional right under the Colorado Constitution to have concealed weapons. It disclaims such a right expressly.
Well, it declaims. I would say that it disclaims such a general right that anybody, and this kind of goes back to what the Heller Court said, that it doesn't say that an individual can carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatsoever purpose. And so I think it would be the same thing. It doesn't mean that the concealed carry is not a constitutional protected right without limitations. The difference would be, yes, that certain individuals, the citizens have a right, a constitutionally protected right, to carry a concealed weapon within the confines of the restrictions that were developed in 2003.
Let's back up. You make a bold statement like that, but the provision of the Constitution on which you rely says just the opposite. It says nothing herein contained shall be construed to justify the practice of carrying concealed weapons. And you say that's a right to carry concealed weapons?
I'm saying that it doesn't, that if you look at this in broad terms, it doesn't say that every individual can carry whatever they want, whenever they want. I think it comes back to the restrictions of time, manner, and place. And that generally says that not every individual can carry a concealed weapon.
It says a lot more than that. It says that no individual has a right to carry a concealed weapon, at least a constitutional right.
But then you move forward to 2003 when the General Assembly passed the Concealed Carry Act, where they basically said that this provision, these laws are enacted based upon the individual's constitutional right to self-protection or self-defense.
So is it your position that the legislature can change the Constitution by law?
I think that they can. No, it is not my position that they can change the Constitution by law. I think that's where you get that distinction, where, yes, the Constitution says that this does not extend or imply that every person should have a right to carry a concealed weapon. However, you do have a right to provide self-defense for yourself under this legislation, under these limitations. So it's not a general, it's not as general as a Second Amendment right.
And excuse me, counsel, I'd like to move on past that issue, and just even assuming that there is a constitutional right of some kind, and that procedural due process is required. Sheriff sent a letter explaining what the grounds were, didn't say what the statutory section was that was being invoked, but did indicate that it was these offenses that had been committed by the two plaintiffs that were the basis, and the circumstances surrounding it were the basis for the revocation. And then the two plaintiffs had an opportunity to submit additional material, which they did, and the sheriff reconsidered and decided to stick with the same determination, but nevertheless, let you know what the, let the plaintiffs know what the grounds were. Now, you've got some arguments based on Copley that a hearing was required, but you would concede, wouldn't you, that the statute has no provision for a hearing in this circumstance?
I would concede that the statute does not specifically mandate a hearing. I think that the Copley decision would say that that is probably maybe the safest and best way that the sheriff could provide procedural due process.
Well, but the problem that you have in Copley is that the sheriff in that instance did, in its initial letter, tell the applicant that, or the person whose permit was an issue, that they had a right to a hearing, or that the sheriff would provide a hearing. Isn't that a distinction between that case and this case? There was nothing said by the sheriff here about a hearing, and there's no requirement to have a hearing. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that in circumstances that the sheriff would be able to provide due process without a hearing, if he were specifically to state exactly the statutory provision for revocation, and basically the sheriff based his decision in his initial letter on arrests, and neither one of these individuals
It mentions arrests, but it was based on the offenses. And you knew which statute was being invoked, didn't you? Because you mentioned in your response, you mentioned the requirements for subsection 2.
Well, for both. Actually, in their responsive letters, they mentioned both criteria. The criteria that has all of the specifics, and then the one that the sheriff ultimately stated that he relied on. So they were, I think, trying to cover both bases, not knowing which it was.
Okay. But the plaintiffs were given that opportunity, and the sheriff to take that into consideration. So why were you deprived of due process then? Why were you plaintiffs deprived of due process?
They weren't told the statutory provision, and secondly, the Concealed Carry Act doesn't allow a sheriff to revoke permits based on a pending case. It allows him to suspend them, but not revoke.
What's your authority for that?
It's actually CRS 1812-203, and it is 3B. That says the sheriff shall suspend the permit until such time as the matter is resolved. And I do want to give Ethel opportunity to answer all of your questions. I was going to try to reserve 7 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and I'm down to less than three. So if I can reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, and then if I haven't answered your question, I certainly hope I can during that time.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Jefferson County Attorney James Burgess, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendants and appellees, the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners and Jefferson County Sheriff Ted Mink. While the appellants, whom I shall generally refer to as the Wrights, only presented this court with one issue on appeal, which is whether the trial court properly determined under Rule 106 that the sheriff had sufficient basis to revoke the Wrights' concealed handgun permits, I believe that inherent in the Wrights' arguments are two other issues, which the court has already touched on one of those, namely the Wrights' entitlement to due process in the revocation of these concealed handgun permits, and second, the proper contents of the record on appeal before this court. Regarding due process, the Wrights naturally rely heavily upon Copley versus Robinson. However, the Copley court appears to have assumed without any analysis that there were protected liberty or property interests at issue in the revocation of a concealed handgun permit. In spite of the overwhelming weight of authority holding that when a governmental body or entity has discretion about whether to grant, revoke, or deny a permit, there can be no protected liberty or property interest in that permit. The Copley court opinion, of course, is not binding on this court, and we will ask the court to not follow Copley's reasoning. The criteria for obtaining a concealed handgun permit in Colorado are contained in CRS 1812-203. Subsection 1 gives you a list of the types of applicants to whom a sheriff shall issue a concealed handgun permit. It includes categories such as a legal resident of the state of Colorado, 21 years of age or older, and someone who's not ineligible to possess a firearm under federal law. These are all clearly delineated categories that don't leave any discretion to a county sheriff about whether to grant or deny. If 1812-203 solely included subsection 1, county sheriffs would not have any discretion about whether to issue, deny, or revoke a permit. And permittees would almost certainly have a protected liberty or property interest in that permit. However, that is not the case. After giving county sheriffs the specifically or strictly delineated list of individuals to whom concealed handgun permits shall be issued, the General Assembly included subsections 2 and 3 in 1812-203 to provide county sheriffs broad discretion to deny or revoke a concealed handgun permit.
Mr. Burgess, do we have to run headlong into Copley? I suppose you could distinguish it simply on the basis of estoppel, as my colleague Judge Terry said. There, the situation was one where the sheriff told the permittee, you're entitled to a hearing. So I'm not sure we really have to, we could affirm this without overruling or saying that we disagree with the division in Copley, could we not?
I believe the court could. However, I believe the Copley decision was incorrect. And the better method would be for this court to correctly state that where there is no protected liberty or property interest, there's no requirement that the due process be given before a concealed handgun permit is revoked, because if that is not distinguished or not followed, that remains the law, and county sheriffs will have this question still up in the air. And again, I don't believe that there's any requirement under the Colorado or United States Constitution that a hearing or adversarial process occur before revocation of a concealed handgun permit occurs. But on that same note, I believe that there are some other issues that do distinguish Copley from this case. In Copley, it was not a revocation that was at issue. In Copley, the permit had already been revoked, and the permittee sought a reissuance of that permit. And as part of the reissuance, an Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office officer had said, if you wish to have this reinstated because these trespass charges have been dismissed, here's how you go about doing it, and you may have a hearing. I don't believe there's any obligation under the law. There's certainly nothing in the Concealed Carry Act that requires you to have a hearing. And I think that may have been some of what was concerning to the Copley court, because this appeared to be indicia of due process, of a trial-like process. Whereas here, the Jefferson County Sheriff certainly does not provide hearings when concealed handgun permits are revoked.
Burgess, what is the basis for upholding a revocation of the permits as opposed to a mere suspension of the permits under the facts relied on by the sheriff here?
If I understand your question correctly, is this addressing Ms. Wright's issue about the suspension of the permit is allowed on the
yes.
certain statutory basis? If you look at the 1812-203, under subsection 3A, it actually says the sheriff shall deny, revoke, or refuse to renew a permit if an applicant or permittee fails to meet one of the criteria listed in subsection 1 of this section and may deny, revoke, or refuse to renew a permit on the grounds specified in subsection 2. That gives the sheriff explicit authority to revoke if he or she has a reasonable belief based upon documented prior behavior of the permittee that they will likely pose a danger to self or others if the handgun permit is not revoked. So I believe the sheriff has explicit statutory authority to revoke and not just suspend the concealed handgun permit.
So are you reading that it's not that the charges have to be resolved, whatever charges are pending, offenses, criminal charges, whatever might be pending against the permittee, but once the sheriff's determination has been resolved?
Actually, no, I believe the sheriff only has to look at documented prior conduct. So the sheriff doesn't, you don't have to have criminal charges, even you don't have to have criminal convictions. You just have to have documented prior conduct by the permittee or applicant is all that the sheriff has to look at. There's no beyond a reasonable doubt standard of review or burden of proof in these cases. It's solely documented prior conduct that gives this sheriff the level of belief.
And is it your position that the files of the offenses that were turned over by the sheriff as part of the record he reviewed, that's the documentation that satisfies the statute?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. I believe we have police reports for each of the incidents referenced. And so, unlike in Copley, where I believe the sheriff was just relying upon a memorandum and independent investigation, here the sheriff, as shown in the record, had police reports from Arvada and the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office upon which he could base his review of the propriety of permitting the Wrights to keep their concealed handgun permits. As I briefly spoken about, the subsections 2 and 3 give the sheriff quite a bit of discretion. If the court parses out the provision, the court will see the breadth of that discretion. First, none of the terms in 1812-203, subsection 2 or 3 is defined. The county sheriff is thus left to determine what does it mean to have a reasonable belief. And then also looking at the words in the statute itself, the words used by the General Assembly, reasonable belief, likely, and may. The sheriff does not have to definitively establish that if an individual's concealed handgun permit is not revoked, the individual will pose a danger to self or others. Rather, a reasonable belief in the likelihood of such danger is all that's required. And each county sheriff is left to determine whether a specific documented fact or situation demonstrates such likelihood to that county sheriff's reasonable belief. And even if a sheriff does have this reasonable belief that an individual will pose a danger to self or others, the sheriff is not required to revoke the permit. You will see in subsection 3, I believe, the sheriff may deny or revoke or refuse to renew a permit on the ground specified in subsection 2. So again, even if the sheriff has this reasonable belief, there's no obligation to revoke the permit. Every single federal and state court that has looked at this issue and considered similar concealed weapon permitting statutes has determined where there's any discretion on the part of the issuing body that cannot create a protected liberty or property interest such as would implicate due process protections prior to the revocation of such permit. Of course, other laws may create a requirement for a hearing, even when there is no liberty or property interest. However, the Concealed Carry Act, as noted by the court, does not contain any such requirement. All that's required is, under 1812-203, subsection 3C, if the sheriff suspends or revokes a permit, the sheriff shall notify the permittee in writing, stating the grounds for suspension or revocation and informing the permittee of the right to seek a second review by the sheriff, to submit additional information for the record, and to seek judicial review pursuant to section 1812-207. And as I believe, as the court noted, the sheriff did all of those things in this instance. With all of this in mind, only one conclusion is possible. Copley was incorrectly decided. The court in Copley appears to have assumed that because the issue arose under Rule 106, there must be a right to due process in the revocation itself. That is simply not the case. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals addressed an almost identical issue in Jacobs, Visconti, and Jacob versus City and Lawrence, which is cited in the Appellee's answer brief. In reviewing a zoning determination, the Tenth Circuit stated, and I quote, "The classification of the rezoning application process as quasi-judicial by the Kansas Supreme Court does not further appellant's expectation of a property interest or otherwise place substantive limitations on official discretion." Again, just because it's a quasi-judicial determination does not mean there must be a protected liberty or property interest at issue in the quasi-judicial determination. The next issue before the court is the proper contents of the record on appeal, whereas here a hearing is not required. In the context of a proceeding to which due process applies, of course, the litigants have a right to review the other side's evidence and to attack that evidence, to rebut it if possible. And in outside of this context, if they do not have the opportunity to review that evidence, it's not properly considered within the record on Rule 106. However, due process does not apply to the revocation of a concealed handgun permit. And nowhere in the Concealed Carry Act is there a requirement that the written notification must include a copy of the records relied upon by the sheriff. Take this for an example. If immediately after the revocation letter were issued, the applicant or permittee had immediately sought judicial review in the district court, they would have had no opportunity to submit additional records to the sheriff, no opportunity to seek a hearing, and in that case, there would be obviously no due process issue, because that's exactly what the statute contemplates, the immediately seeking judicial review with the district court. Thus, in all Rule 106 appeals, the record on appeal before the trial court and this court is the entire record that was in front of the sheriff when he made his determination that the rights, concealed handgun permits should be revoked, even if the rights did not have prior opportunity to review that record before it was filed with the district court. Finally, turning to the merits of the court's Rule 106 review, the rights have never contended that the events that led to the issuance of the summonses to them were insufficient to provide the sheriff a reasonable belief that they would likely pose a danger to themselves or others if their concealed handgun permits were not revoked. Rather, the rights have focused on what they viewed as procedural issues with the sheriff's revocation and the fact that the sheriff knew of certain of these contacts with law enforcement before the revocation occurred. The concealed handgun permits were issued in November of 2008, and so the right's narrow focus avoids the obvious. These two law enforcement contacts for Mr. Edwin Wright occurred after the concealed handgun permit was issued, as did the one law enforcement contact with Mr. Austin Wright, which were noted in the initial revocation letters. Each of those letters provided the applicants notice as well as at issue before the sheriff, and provided the sheriff this reasonable belief based upon documented previous behavior that both of the rights would likely pose a danger to themselves or to others. There's no requirement in the Concealed Carry Act that the rights be convicted of a crime for the sheriff to consider their behavior. The law solely requires documented previous behavior. As noted earlier, for each of these, we had police records. These eyewitness accounts that were included in the records indicated the rights hold the law in disrespect, endanger the lives of law enforcement officers, escalate arguments into physical confrontations, and reinitiate physical violence even after a fight has been broken up by other parties. Taken together, these incidents demonstrate that the sheriff could have a reasonable belief based upon documented prior behavior that the rights would likely pose a danger to themselves or others if their concealed handgun permits were not revoked. At that, unless the court has any further questions, I would rest at this point.
I just have one question about the standard of review. This is not a usual 106A4 standard of review. Isn't it modified somewhat by the statute in that the burden of proof is on the sheriff this instance?
That is correct, Your Honor. It's an odd situation here, but yes, the sheriff must prove by clear and convincing evidence that he had a reasonable belief that the rights, if their concealed handgun permits were not revoked, would likely pose a danger to themselves or others. So yes, that is correct. The burden is on us. For that, I thank the court.
Mr. Burgess. Mr. Wright.
The General Assembly sought to prevent exactly what the sheriff is saying he can do. Jefferson County Sheriff doesn't have to hold a hearing or provide due process, but another county, I think it was Douglas County, maybe in Kirkland, they do. Because that sheriff was willing to hold a hearing, then due process impacts. I think that Copley read, together with the cases that Copley relied on, clearly states that there is due process. A hearing may be the best way for a sheriff to provide due process, but if he chooses not to hold a hearing, that doesn't mean that due process goes out the window. These two individuals, prior to the revocation, were never afforded the opportunity to review internal documents, cross-examine witnesses, examine the evidence, present relevant evidence, or speak on their own behalf. The letters, initial letters from the sheriff, clearly defined the reason for revocation as being arrests. It did not talk about the underlying activity or conduct of these individuals. It talked about the arrests, and the arrests were erroneous. Austin Wright in particular, the sheriff came back after he sought second review and said, oh yeah, you're right, you weren't arrested, but I'm still going to revoke your permit based on other, some general conclusory other police reports and other matters that we have information regarding. The statute and due process and the cases, I look at Punic case in particular, those cases require more than that. Does the sheriff have to give a 20-page detailed synopsis? Probably not. But he at least has to provide what in those events led him to believe that these individuals would be a danger to themselves.
The letters did mention the arrest, but they also mentioned the offense, correct?
Well, the...
It was erroneous that there was an arrest, but the offenses, in fact, had been charged.
For third-degree assault, which neither of these individuals were convicted of third-degree assault. They pled out to much less offenses.
Right, but the offenses had been charged, right? That was not erroneous.
Been charged, but then we get into the pending cases. If they're going to rely on these two cases, those are pending cases. Just in close, fundamental due process must be afforded according to Copley. And simply because the sheriff didn't hold a hearing in this case and they did in Copley, that would seem to imply that Copley was afforded more due process than these individuals were. And I am out of time. I thank you very much for your time and consideration and ask on behalf of appellants that you find for them, reverse the sheriff's revocation of the permits and award them attorney's fees and costs.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Thank you again, Mr. Burgess. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes